entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Oh, that it is. Hello there. Welcome in to the best of Downtown on a Sunday morning on the 29th day of July. Rich Kimble and Carrie Haskell here with you. Downtown presented every day and Sunday mornings by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. It's our weekly look back at our favorite recent conversations. Good ones this morning, including Charlotte Wilder of Sports Illustrated and SITV. Author John Connolly will discuss his new book, The Woman in the Woods. We'll talk about the Beatles with Colin Fleming, who's published a couple of recent articles, one in Rolling Stone and one in Salon. And we get things rolling by checking in on the Celtics. It's been an interesting offseason for them. Good news now with Marcus Smart all signed up for the next 4 years and ready to go. Gordon Hayward back playing basketball. All seems to be right in the Celtics world. We talked about that and also celebrated a birthday with our friend John Corrales of RedsArmy.com and the Locked On Celtics podcast. Happy birthday, John.
Oh, thank you, sir. Really appreciate that.
Man, 29 looks good on you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, John. I was going to say, I'm looking forward to finally being able to drink legally, but yeah, we'll go with that too.
Both of them work, absolutely. Let's talk about what's going on with the Celtics, and I'm not good with money, so I need you to help me figure out what are the luxury tax concerns that the Celtics have, and is it anything they have to worry about for a while?
So with the re-signing of Marcus Smart, they've made some a couple of moves here, trading Abdel Nader away, but they're still somewhere around $3 million over the luxury tax, which for the Celtics owners, that's not much. They'll end up paying, if they keep it at that rate, they'll end up paying like an extra million, $2 million, something like that for the team. Not a big deal in the short term. But what happens is in 3 or 4 years, they have a thing called the repeater tax, and that basically doubles your tax bill. And when you look at what the Celtics have coming up, that this team's going to get really expensive really fast. You have the potential for Kyrie Irving opting out and getting a deal starting somewhere in the $30 million range, with Gordon Hayward already making that much money. And then in a couple of years, Jaylen Brown wants to get paid. Then after that, Jason Tatum's going to have to get paid. And as you know, you see, the salary is going to start adding up a lot. And if you are a taxpayer in 3 out of 4 years, then you become subject to the repeater tax, and that gets the team very, very expensive. So, and we saw that with Oklahoma City, where getting rid of Carmelo Anthony saved them something like $50 or $60 or $70 million just by getting rid of his $25 million salary. So that's how bad it can be. So our thought, us covering the team, is that you probably want to avoid that for as long as possible. So the Celtics may make some moves, and we saw them start to do that with the Nader trade, to lessen that tax bill. And if they can avoid it this season, then they push off that repeater tax for one more year down the road. And it's a matter of not just saving the owner's money. They're fine. They can probably afford that. It's just a matter of team building. And if the asset, the Boston Celtics, get too expensive and start to operate at a loss, the theory is that rich people don't want to lose money. So that's where we are with the luxury tax. Try to figure out a few ways to maybe put that off so the Celtics can afford to pay these guys for the long term, so we can see this 5, 6, 7 year plan all the way through.
You mentioned the Marcus Smart deal. It sure looks from the outside like a pretty good deal for everybody.
Yeah, it might be a little bit less than what Marcus Smart wanted, but it might also be a little bit more than the Celtics might have had to pay. But they, I think, were doing a couple of things. I think, first of all, they're paying Marcus Smart his fair market value, as they determined. They probably could have played a little bit of more hardball and paid him a little bit less. But if they offered him less, maybe he would have been gone after a year, after signing a qualifying offer and leaving as an unrestricted free agent. They clearly value Marcus Smart, so they now have him long term. And it sends a signal to the rest of the league, to the rest of the agents, to the rest of the guys on their team, a lot of whom have contracts coming up, that we aren't going to try to mess with you. We aren't going to just try to squeeze every last cent out of you. We will talk to you and negotiate in good faith. So there is a message being sent to the rest of the team when it comes to that. Everybody who's upcoming looks at Marcus Smart and that negotiation and is bracing themselves. So that message, I think, was sent. The other thing that they're doing with this deal is they're giving themselves a mid-level contract that they didn't have before. When we talk about potential trades for superstars, the Celtics had a bunch of guys making $20 million or more, and then a bunch of guys making like $6 million or less. And when we talked about the Kawhi Leonard trade, then you start to have to say, well, Jaylen Brown plus a few other guys might sound like enough talent-wise, but it doesn't match salary. You got to throw something else in, and then it gets to be too much. With Marcus Smart making $11, $12, $13 million a year, now it makes the salary matching a little bit easier. Not that they're looking to trade Marcus Smart, but if an Anthony Davis does become available down the road next year or whatever, they have a contract that makes the matching of salaries and the matching of talent going out and coming in a little bit easier to deal with. So team building in a number of ways going on here with this contract.
John Corrales with us here on Downtown. Reason number 78, why I'm glad Danny Ainge is in charge of the Celtics and not me. I fall in love with guys. If I knew Isaiah Thomas wanted to come back, I'd have made it happen.
Yeah, I often say I'd be a very terrible general manager because you have to have that kind of coldness to you. Yeah, if Isaiah called us up, and I think most people would say, oh, yes, come on in. But it's just not the right fit. And it's hard to kind of say that a year ago it would have been the right fit, and now all of a sudden it's not. But it's not. And I think that Isaiah is probably better off going to a different situation. I'm not 100% sold on Denver actually being that situation. I thought Orlando might have been actually a bit better because he could have flourished a little bit more. But whatever, he's in a different place. And I just don't think him in Boston with this team as currently constructed was really the right place for him to be. Now, each year, each offseason, if he's still going on those year-to-year contracts, maybe there will be a place at some point, but not now.
So what's the likely next move for the Celtics?
Well, that's going to be an interesting question because right now I think they're going to do a couple little ancillary things. We're going to see if they can get Jabari Bird to maybe agree to a two-way contract. They may try to sell him on, look, we'll start you on the two-way, but if we can get ourselves under the tax, then we can bring you on and maybe make you a full NBA contract at some point during the season. If they are intent on getting under the tax, they have two obvious options in front of them. One, trading Gershon Yabusele to somebody with cap space to take back a player that's waivable or a pick, a heavily protected pick, so they can get rid of salaries that way. If they trade Gershon, they get just under the luxury tax, and they basically can't do anything else. The other obvious move would be to trade Marcus Morris in the same fashion. You call up Sacramento, you call up Atlanta, you do the same type of deal, a heavily protected pick or something, and now you get yourself a couple million under the luxury tax, and then you can do something like give Jabari Bird a minimum contract or wait till the buyout market and see if anybody useful can come along, and you can give a player then that kind of contract and stay under the luxury tax. So those would be the only moves left. I think other than that, they're just going to kind of wait and see.
And some good news. It looks like Gordon Hayward is ready to get out there and start playing some basketball.
Yeah, always tantalizing to see the Gordon Hayward workouts posted on his social media. He looks good. He's out there, step back, playing in the post. He looks like a guy who's just normally working out. If you had been abducted by aliens a year ago and you came back and you saw that video, you would just think, oh, okay, he's getting ready for the season. So he looks good. I think right now he's pretty close. If he's not already playing 5-on-5, he will be in the next couple of weeks. And at that point, it's just getting himself into shape. The only question I have, I'm very positive on his ankle and his ability to come back. I think physically he will be fine. I think the only question is mentally, can he go out and play the same way that he played before? There's a certain fearlessness. Can he go out in traffic, get a back pick, and catch an alley-oop? Can he go out there and do the same kind of play without being afraid of getting hurt again? And if he can, if he's there mentally, I think physically, personally, I think he's going to be fine.
I feel good if you feel good about it. John Corrales, RedsArmy.com, Locked On Celtics podcast. John, appreciate it as always, and have a great subdued birthday celebration, or we'll be reading about it in the papers tomorrow.
Well, you know, it's a Tuesday, so you really got to go looking for trouble if you're getting into that kind of headline-making stuff on a Tuesday. So we'll see. Maybe the weekend. I'll put it off till the weekend.
All right. Well, we hope you enjoy it either way, and we'll catch you again next week.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
That's John Corrales here on the Best of Downtown on your Sunday morning. When we come back, we check in with our friend Charlotte Wilder, getting it done for Sports Illustrated and SITV.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Biking season is here, and the only way to be sure that you're road or trail ready is to bring your bike to Slipping Gears Cycling, Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts. At 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, before prime riding season slips away. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates, shop in person and online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Back on the Best of Downtown. Your Sunday morning. Our next guest recently took on a new job at Sports Illustrated, a senior writer for the magazine, and also working on video projects, documentaries, and her own show, The Wilder Project, on SITV. Charlotte Wilder joined us earlier this week.
Hey, Rich. Great to hear your voice again.
Great to have you back on with us. Man, we haven't talked to you since the Sports Illustrated gig happened, and this thing is just going great for you.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I know, I'm sorry, I've been sort of running all over the place. But yeah, I could not be happier with the way this job is going. It's just, it's been really fun so far.
Well, listen, I know I understand where I fall in the hierarchy here. If you can be hanging out with Stanley Cup champions, that's much better than talking to me.
Oh no, it's not, Rich. You're the top. you come before anyone.
Well,
you know
I'm glad to hear that. You did have one of our favorites on the show. I saw that our friend Josh Gondelman was on with you.
Yes, he's the best. He's such a lovely guy and a really good friend of mine. And so I said, Josh, would you do me a favor? You come on my show. And he was like, oh, I would love to. And we just had so much fun. I actually just watched a cut of it. It'll come out this week. And it was a really fun time.
So for anybody who is uninitiated for whatever reason, how would you describe the Wilder Project to them?
Oh, man. How would I describe it? Well, it's a show that I have on SITV, which is our streaming service. And each week has a theme, and I have a guest, and that guest comes on, and we sort of talk about themes in sports. Like this week with Josh was sports meltdowns, which was really fun. You know, the best times athletes have totally lost it in professional sports.
Nope. Do we lose Charlotte? Oh, no. We have reestablished contact here with Charlotte Wilder. Sports Illustrated can't buy you a decent cell phone, for God's sakes?
I know. This is my fault. That was not supposed to happen.
No, it's all right. You know, we'll blame it on Char. It was her doing, right?
Oh, yeah, my alter ego, Aunt Char, she messes everything up, let me tell you.
She still has a rotary dial cell phone, I think.
She does. It's on its last legs, but it's hanging in there.
Now, well, Charlotte, we care about you, and so I say this from a place of love and concern. Is it time for an intervention when it comes to your affection for Jay Cutler?
Oh, boy. Well, have you been watching his new reality show?
Only because I saw you tweet about it, yes.
Well, listen, then you know that it's really the most magical thing we've got going for us as a nation right now, Rich.
There's no question about it, and he's every bit as Jay Cutler-ish as you hoped he would be.
Oh, my God, he's exactly as Jay Cutler-ish. You know, the whole joke when he was playing in the NFL was that he, not that he didn't care, but, you know, he never betrayed much emotion, and you see that kind of holds true in his personal life as he's trying to convince his wife to move houses.
He's just a little ray of sunshine that has been sent to us when we need it most.
He really is. I feel like we're very blessed.
Now, real live rays of sunshine are coming out of your old stomping grounds in Boston. How about those Red Sox?
Oh, my God, I know. Can you believe it?
It's crazy. I thought they'd be good, but I had no idea they'd be this good.
I didn't either. I was really, really worried about the Yankees when the season started. And, you know, I think this might be one of the best squads ever. I mean, there's a chance they could do the damn thing this year.
Absolutely. So as you watch, whether it's the Red Sox or your Patriots, anybody else, is there an athlete out there, not counting Jay Cutler, that you're just wildly entertained by, regardless of their level of talent, but because of the kind of person they are?
Oh, man, that's a really good question. I think LeBron will always entertain me just because he's such a big name, but also because he's so interesting. You know, what, even down to his fashion choices, like when he wore the short suits. I love seeing what he's up to, and I think it's only going to get more entertaining as he starts his tenure with the Lakers with the cast of characters they've assembled around him.
We haven't talked with you, Charlotte, since you had a weird little online thing with poor, confused Ed Werder.
Oh, yeah, that was weird. For those of you who don't follow me on Twitter, which is probably for the best, I got into a little bat. Well, I didn't, but I tweeted out a job, and I said, you know, let me know if you're interested in this, especially if you're a woman, which Ed took to mean that I was excluding men, even though, you know, just trying to help out because sports media is 90% male and I think we can do better than that. But yeah, it turned into this whole back and forth. I ended up on TMZ. Pretty wild.
Yeah, but as I understand from our friend Chad Finn, it certainly helped the company because you got a ton of people applying for the job, right?
We did. Yeah, it was actually really exciting. We had, you know, a ton of people apply, a lot more women than would have if that hadn't happened, I think. And, you know, I got a lot of lovely messages from people. So overall, I'd say it was pretty positive. I felt, you know, Ed had to be the one to die on that hill, I guess.
Let's also talk about somebody you've worked with who's leaving his job, and we're all sad about that. You filled in for him. You're a frequent guest on NPR's Only a Game. We're going to miss Bill Littlefield so much.
Oh, I know. Can you believe this weekend is his last show?
No, I can't. It's not fair.
No, he's, you know, that show is an institution, but also Bill is, you know, it's hard to imagine that show without him, honestly.
So for you, Charlotte, what's up next? When can people see this new edition of The Wilder Project?
It'll be out this week, either tomorrow or Thursday. And I have a story on the 25th anniversary of The Sandlot that I'm working on.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, and I've got three documentaries I'm actually in the process of producing, and there are going to be two articles that go along with those. So I'm really excited. It's a busy time over here, and I may have some news about a podcast soon, too, so stay tuned.
That is fantastic. Well, I'm not just saying it because you're here. I said it on the air yesterday. If we keep this show going, down the road, not too far, we're going to say to people, you know, Charlotte Wilder used to be on our show before she became fill in the blank, whatever it is, best-selling author, Pulitzer Prize winner, you name it. You're so talented. We love your work and love having you on with us.
Rich, you're going to make me cry on the sidewalk in New York. Thank you so much. No. I cannot tell you how much that means to me, and I will always come on your show, so you're stuck with me, whether you like it or not.
That's Charlotte Wilder of Sports Illustrated and SITV here on the Best of Downtown. When we come back, we'll talk Beatles. Colin Fleming up next.
We may not be the biggest, but we're definitely the best. Here at Tim's Plumbing, we know that when a plumbing issue pops up, you need it fixed. And not just fixed fast, but fixed right. That's been our mission from day one. The master licensed technicians here at Tim's Plumbing specialize in installations, repiping, and service repair. We do new construction as well. And we're so focused on customer satisfaction that 100% of Tim's Plumbing customers become repeat customers. Here at Tim's Plumbing, we replace and repair water heaters, install and repair well pumps. We even do kitchen and bath remodeling. Keep our numbers handy. You can call us at 735-4969 or 327-1620. Those numbers again, 735-4969 or 327-1620. You can also learn more about the many services we offer by liking us on Facebook or by clicking your way to timsplumbingmaine.com. That's timsplumbingmaine.com. At Tim's Plumbing, service is our specialty.
Hey, Rex, Fiona, the mail's here.
I was supposed to fetch that. My bad.
Any cardboard boxes today?
More fan letters. Dear Green Acres Kennel Shop, thank you for boarding our dog and cat while we were away. It's easy to see why you've been voted the Bangor region's best kennel every year since 2002.
That's 1906 in dog years.
She goes on to ask, why do cats play with yarn?
Because we can't knit.
Here's another. Dear Green Acres Kennel Shop, your dog groomer is the best. Louie never looked or felt better. Why does Louie turn around three times before he lies down?
Because dogs can't count to four.
Here's one. Dear Green Acres Kennel Shop, do dogs like to go to obedience school?
They do when it's at Green Acres Kennel Shop. We were voted one of the top 30 dog trainers in all of New England. Private and group training classes are available. We make you and your dog best friends for life.
How do you think we learned how to talk?
Green Acres Kennel Shop, voted one of the top 10 kennels in New England. 1653 Union Street, Bangor, greenacreskennel.com, and on Facebook. Your dog may not actually talk. Woof.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, a home away from home. Woof, woof.
That's Beatles, of course, from the BBC's 1963 broadcast of Pop Goes the Beatles. Our friend Colin Fleming wrote about that appearance in a recent edition of Rolling Stone and RollingStone.com. We talked with Colin about that piece and another one he wrote about Yellow Submarine for Salon. Now, let's start with what you wrote about at Rolling Stone, RollingStone.com. And a fascinating time in the Beatles' career when they were already pretty big in Britain, but had not hit the scene yet here in America. And it's the 1963 Pop Goes the Beatles series on BBC.
Right. They were going to Maida Vale Studios, and they were basically acting as human jukeboxes. They would field requests from people. People would write in on postcards with little pictures of their beloved mop tops, and they would joke around with the host. They would take the piss, as it were. And they would play a number of songs that they just wouldn't visit, really, on vinyl during their career. And so they had this one session on June 2nd, 1963, that was one of the high water marks for me of everything the Beatles ever achieved. And it's really quite an interesting couple of days, because the day before, they are over at EMI, and they are only knocking out a little song called She Loves You, which I think is their first mature masterpiece and one of their four or five best songs. When you listen to that song, it's really striking how wise it is. It's written in this kind of second-person directive-based style, and it has this amazing energy. And energy isn't just like, let's play fast, let's be up-tempo. Energy is something that I think informs every single great work of art there has ever been. It will always have energy. And they took that energy into the next day, and they basically said, you know what, let's take on our heroes. Let's show the people out there that the people who came before us, Elvis and Chuck Berry and Carl Perkins, cannot touch what we can do with their material and with our own new material.
Well, and they started by setting the bar high, the holy grail for Elvis aficionados, taking on his version of That's All Right, Mama.
Right. They did something. If you watch the documentary film, I still think it's the best documentary on the Beatles, called The Complete Beatles from 1982. There's an interview at the beginning of it with Jerry Marsden of Jerry and the Pacemakers. And he basically performs this Lonnie Donegan number, the skiffle guy. And he does the skiffle version of it, and he says, what we did in Liverpool was we would rock this kind of stuff up. We would take what he calls acky-dacky music, and we would rock it up. Well, Elvis is already pretty rocked up to begin with in 1954 when he's doing That's All Right, Mama, but the Beatles rock it up even more. They imbue this song with this rhythm and blues backbeat. Keep in mind that Elvis song did not have a drummer on it, right? It's just the trio.
Right.
The time. And they sort of overlay this backbeat. You can't underestimate. It sounds simple, like, oh, it's the beat. It's on the two and it's on the four. The beat that the Beatles had in their name is just gigantic, and it's sort of this countrified, beaty, rhythm and blues stomp through this number with the Paul McCartney vocal and these wonderful, like, textured, countrified George Harrison lines, and it's just like, okay, well, I guess we're here to have an old-fashioned cutting contest, basically.
And they went on to play a little Chuck Berry, Arthur Alexander, and what kind of a message did this send to the record-buying public and the listeners of BBC in the summer of 1963?
I don't think it would have really sent anything message-wise to them. They were getting to hear this group that was becoming sort of this country-based phenomenon, and like you said earlier, they weren't really close to breaking in the States yet. Within the Beatles chronology, they had a different kind of relationship with time. I mean, that's coming in February, which seems pretty close, but when we're talking about the things that a great artist is doing within a two-day period, within a 10-day period, within a week, that kind of thing, you really have to almost go hour by hour. So if you're a British schoolboy and you're taping this off the radio, you probably have already had your mind blown by these people, but you're not really parsing it out where you're saying, like, oh, okay, they're taking on, like, the blackest rhythm and blues in Arthur Alexander. They're going after kind of this rockabilly with Elvis. They're taking on Carl Perkins, who was, like, extra rockabilly beyond Elvis. They're doing Chuck Berry. They're doing their own version of There's a Place, which doesn't get many live airings. They're doing Clarabella by the Jot of Mars, like this Bill Haley kind of like backup band, and you get to hear Lennon wailing away on harmonica, which you hardly ever get in terms of live recording. You're not going to be thinking like, oh, they're showing they can dominate you every which way you want to play the game. But when we look back on it later and we add a little perception, a little clarity of thought, we can say, yeah, they are beating the bag out of their heroes.
Well, and those were the kind of things they'd been doing and playing, you know, the Cavern Club, the clubs of Liverpool and Hamburg. They'd been doing those cover songs for years.
They had been, right. But it's like something like Soldier of Love. I think you could make a pretty good case that Soldier of Love is the best cover they ever did. And we are talking some of the best covers in the history of rock and roll in terms of Twist and Shout and Money. And I almost wonder now if it would be considered like cultural appropriation, because Arthur Alexander was just viewed as the blackest music, basically, there had ever been in terms of pop music. And they are, I don't want to say they're out-blacking him, but they're out-souling him, which was very strange because it's almost like when we got soccer over here in, like, this country and we started to, like, become competitive with the World Cup. It's not really our thing, right? And the U.S. doesn't make the World Cup in the last go-round. And it's like going to catch on eventually, but it's like it's not our thing. Like hockey, right? Remember when hockey was like not really a huge thing here, and it was surprising when there was like Bobby Carpenter, right, getting 50 goals in the NHL. Rock and roll was not England's thing. This is just a few years in. They just have been doing the skiffle, And these guys are doing this kind of crazy rock and roll, and they are pulling from so many more influences with the Broadway show tunes and the rhythm and blues. And other groups usually just pick kind of like one go-to sound, whether it's Chuck Berry, whether it's the blues like the Stones. But the Beatles, they were doing this weird, different kind of amalgamation, and this is the best one-session air-shot version of that.
And a fantastic vocal by Lennon, as you write about on Soldier of Love.
It is, his vocal, but like, let's not forget, too, the backing vocals. Now, no one ever gets into this. I'm doing a book on the Beatles called Same Band You've Never Known, An Alternative Musical History of the Beatles, because I think people just focus on the Hey Judes and the Sgt. Peppers, and that doesn't really tell their musical story. Their musical story is more endemic in something like the backing vocals of Soldier of Love, because that is straight out of girl group pop. And no other British band was doing girl group pop. It would have been seen as effeminate, almost. But they had no compunction with that whatsoever, and it always sounds soulful. So you would oftentimes get these harmony vocals from McCartney when Lennon's singing lead, and you couldn't even really tell often who was doing the harmony and who was doing the lead. But this is just straight up Lennon doing the lead and this wonderful Harrison and McCartney backing vocal, and it coalesces into this groove where you could have been like Slim Harpo's backing band. You could have been as bluesy as it came in this country, in the South, and you would have been like, these white guys that transcends color, they can do their thing.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Now, that piece in Rolling Stone, rollingstone.com. I loved what you wrote in Salon about the restorative melancholia of Yellow Submarine. It has been released in theaters here 50 years later in limited theaters this summer. And as you point out, this is a project that the Beatles not only weren't really involved in, but maybe didn't think would be successful either.
No, they thought it was ridiculous. They thought it was going to be basically like the Flintstones, except with Liverpudlian singing group in it. And they did come later in life to appreciate it. And I think it was like Lennon was watching it late one night. And he's like, hey, this is pretty good. It's kind of witty. It has his sense of humor. But what I've always really liked about it, and I think it's understated in terms of what the Beatles did, and what the Beatles also had this spirit, too, where you'll find these works, and Yellow Submarine is one of them. And it's something I get into in this book I'm doing, where they had nothing to do with the work, but their spirit managed to sort of pervade the work. You see it with that complete Beatles documentary. You see it with the tell-all biography, which I still think is the best one, even though it's kind of trashy, The Love You Make. And we have it here with this film where it starts off right away. It's like Ringo Starr, the cartoon version, he has the blues. And I just love how axiomatic the film lets sadness be. That whole notion of letting something be. I have a friend, like, with the things that I'm sometimes dealing with, he'll just say, like, look, this is awful. I've never wished this upon anyone. Just let it be what it is right now. And do what you're doing, and eventually things are going to sort themselves out in the large-scale way you want them to. And I see that, like, with Yellow Submarine. It just lets things be. It's okay to be blue-hued. You can be bluish and not be a blue meanie, as it were, and go about your life. And I think that's sort of how the film starts.
And even the blue meanies, as you point out, are the perfect villains for this story because, they don't like their jobs.
Yeah, the Blue Meanies are awesome because they have, like, yeah, they want to destroy love and everything. But you know what? Love hardly ever even exists. It's difficult to find. So the Blue Meanies at least have this moral code, which I really enjoy. Like, I enjoy a villain who, like, doesn't think they're a villain because they think they're doing right and they, like, maintain this sort of parameter, these codes they have. So, like, one of the Blue Meanies says the Blue Meanie asked another one a question and the answer of the question he answers in the affirmative. And the Blue Meanie who's doing the querying, he freaks out, even though he wants an accurate answer. He says, we meanies will never say yes, we only take no for an answer. And it's like, this is awesome. These dudes are really, really weird. But like they're that consistent with their code. Like you see that same kind of humor in something like Whistnail and I. like these two out-of-work actors in London, right, in the 60s. But they have this code, this verbal-based code, and you get that with the meanies. You get that, too, with sort of Jeremy, who's quite literally, his species, he's a boob. But he's also a polymath. He's the smartest person intellectually, person boob, in the entire film. And it's just this wonderful kind of zany weirdness.
And that's the beauty of it, too, is that it allows you, I don't want to say wallow in the melancholia, but there's nothing wrong with going there sometimes. And as we've talked about before, you know, you can't appreciate those moments of happiness if you're always pretending to be happy or giving that public front that says you're happy.
One of the best scenes in A Hard Day's Night, and I wouldn't be surprised if the makers of Yellow Submarine saw that scene and thought, you know what, we can do something with this in cartoon form, which is not a point I've ever seen anyone make, is when Ringo Starr, actual Ringo Starr, is hungover for that sequence near the end of A Hard Day's Night, where he's walking on the side of like this, it's not even a river, right? It's not even like this sluice. It's kind of like this dirty industrial sort of canal that just is leaching the goodness out of the earth. And he's stomping about in the mud, and he meets a kid who's up to truancy, and like his little friends are down below, and Starr's hungover, and he's just walking around, and they're filming this, and it's like, yeah, this is kind of, I like this pace. This melancholia is kind of, I don't know, it's regenerating almost. Like your energy is going to follow from this fallow period after. And that's sort of how Yellow Submarine works. It goes sort of very down tempo in the beginning. The colors are a little closer to a black and white and this full-throated shout of vermilion and all of that. And it just sets this mood where it's like, look, you know what? I don't have to be like, a lot of shows, I feel like they almost try to shame you by saying you are not part of this group. You want in, but you don't have in, whether that's The Sopranos or whatever. Like, you're not in this group. And Yellow Submarine, the film, it doesn't do that. It's just like, you know what? Maybe you're not feeling great today. This is, you know, come with us. It'll be cool. It'll work out the way you want it to work out.
Check out Colin's pieces, the recent ones in Salon and Rolling Stone on the Beatles. And the best thing to do is go to Colin's website, colinflemminglit.com, and you can check out all of his Beatle writings there and everything else that he's been working on of late. Great stuff, as always. Colin, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week.
Sounds good.
It's Colin Fleming here on The Best of Downtown. When we come back, we talk with author John Connolly. Prolific writer. He's got a brand new book in the Charlie Parker series called The Woman in the Woods. And that's next on Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Spring's the time for everything new, fresh, innovative. Time for the brand new, all redesigned Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
The 2019 Ram 1500 is awesome. With more everything, more storage,
more performance,
more technology,
more efficiency,
and more leather.
In the new Ram 1500, there's safety all around you. It's the strongest Ram ever. Capable, built to serve, rugged,
and refined.
Start your own rebellion. Get yourself a Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
Don't miss the
2018 Jeep Wrangler, an all-new version of a true icon at Hartley's.
Diesel power, hybridization, and full-wheel, all-wheel drive are options. Wrangler is legendary for sport, fun, and work. The incredible 2018 is the most accommodating and comfortable Wrangler yet.
The new Ram 1500 and the all-new 2018 design Jeep Wrangler. Check them out at Hartley's.
The best deals on new Ram 1500s and 2019 Jeep Wranglers aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country in Newport, hartleyscountry.com.
Thinking of making home improvements to increase efficiency? Well, there's no time like the present. And the people at Penobscot Home Performance want you to know that efficiency main rebates have increased from $700 to $1,000 per zone as of May 1st. Also, anyone with Bangor Gas can get rebates for $2,000 per insulation zone up to $5,000. Call to get your free home energy audit at 469-6100 or visit PenobscotHomePerformance.com. We're back on the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. Rich Kimball here, along with Kerry Haskell. Our next guest on Downtown is one of the most prolific and talented writers around. We had him on just a couple of months ago to discuss his novel, He, but he's got a brand new one in the very popular Charlie Parker series, the 16th book in that series of detective stories, mysteries, thrillers, and even a hint of the supernatural in this one involving a telephone. John Connolly joined us from Dublin to talk about The Woman in the Woods. Wonderful to have you back on with us here. The new book is entitled The Woman in the Woods, and we'll talk about that in detail in a moment, but why is it that you've chosen Maine for the setting of so many of these books?
Well, I used to work in the state. I was briefly employed as the world's worst waiter by the Black Point Inn out in Scarborough, and I when I came to begin writing the books, I wanted to give Parker an affection for a place that I had an affection for, because I'd grown to like Maine an awful lot. I had come back repeatedly, and also, it wasn't really colonized by crime writers in the same way that somewhere like New York or Boston or New Orleans was colonized. It seemed like kind of virgin territory in a way. It was a place that I could use in a slightly different way, I thought. I had these fantastic, this gorgeous landscape, these wonderful changes of scenery. And in mystery fiction, landscape is very important. You know, we tend to associate detectives with the places they move through. So, you know, we associate Raymond Chandler, Philip Marlowe with Los Angeles, or, you know, Spencer with Boston. And so if you can find a landscape that nobody else has taken and try to make it your own and mythologize it, that's quite unusual. That's quite an opportunity to have.
Well, and you've certainly done that in this new book with the area just to the north of us up in Dover, where the body of a woman is found in the woods, but then things take a decidedly different turn and go in all kinds of different directions, from a detective story to a thriller, and touches of the supernatural as well.
Yeah, I've always liked mixing the genres in that way. You know, most writers write what they read, and I was brought up reading mystery fiction, but also I read ghost stories, and they're very much part of my upbringing. You know, I'm Irish, and I grew up in Dublin, and we were always very comfortable with mythology and gothic stories. I didn't see anything wrong with mixing them. It wasn't really done very much in the genre when I started. But I was very comfortable with it. And so it adds a kind of slightly different element to it, I think. The idea that, people aren't evil. People do things, bad deeds. They do things because they're selfish, or they're angry, or they're in love, or they're frightened, and they act out. And sometimes they'll do awful things. But most people aren't evil. Yet very, very, very occasionally we'll encounter a situation where we just think, my goodness, how can somebody do that? How can they seem to leave their humanity entirely behind? And I suppose the Parker books argued that on those occasions, maybe people draw from a deeper, older well. Maybe there's something kind of outside ourselves, and that's the force that we draw on. So I've always been interested in speculating on those kind of levels of evil, from the kind of borderline, general, selfish, angry stuff to something much, much odder and darker.
Well, and in this book, an object, one in particular, takes on a life of its own. And I don't want to give too much away in the story, but I wanted to join in burying that children's toy phone.
Yeah, that's it. You're always looking for, it's not really terrifying when, you know, some, well, maybe it probably would be if some big creepy monster suddenly jumped out, you know, when you're walking through some fantasy land. What's really strange is when something that is so, we're so comfortable with, that seems so unthreatening, suddenly becomes a source of danger and disquiet to us. And so, yeah, what happens in the book is that a woman's body is found, as you say, but it's clear that she gave birth shortly before she died, and yet there's no sign of a child. And so Parker is asked to try and find this child as a service to this dead woman. And in a house near the edge of the woods, a child's toy phone begins to ring, and when he picks it up, he hears a woman's voice on the end of the line, and the woman asks him, what do they name you? And it's clear that something has found a way to communicate with them. And I found a lovely quiet quote from J.M. Barrie, who was the creator of Peter Pan. And he said the only ghosts he thought existed, really existed, were the ghosts of young mothers come to check on their children. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was such a fantastic idea, you know. And actually, I came across that quote, you know, I was halfway through writing the book, and I thought, wow, there's somebody thinking along exactly the same lines that I was.
Well, it works very powerfully in the book. We're talking with John Connolly. His newest is The Woman in the Woods. And I finished the book last night in bed, and it was great. I loved it, even though, I don't know, it was about almost 500 pages, but it was such a quick read because I couldn't put it down. But we had kind of a windy, rainy night, and I had a window partially open, and it was rattling the curtains and the blinds, and at one point, I may have taken your name in vain. I was convinced I heard scratching on the windows, and I thought, it's Karis. Oh, no.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's lovely. There's something lovely about unsettling people. It's very easy to kind of shock people, and it's quite easy to gross them out. But to unsettle them is very, very different. I had an experience very similar to that. I brought a book called Dark Matter away with me to my house. I have a house in Portland, and I often come over in winter to write. And I was reading this book, as I'd been sent an advance copy, and it's a ghost story set in the Arctic, in the depths of winter when there's no light at all. And I remember sitting in my house in Portland in the dead of night reading it and thinking, you know, I think I'll just leave this one until the morning. You know, not that I'm frightened or anything, you know, but maybe I'm just a little bit tired. You know? So it's lovely that a book, and actually a book can have that effect, and it's often much more than a film does. In a film, all the decisions are made for us. Somebody has decided what we're going to see and when we're going to see it and what it's going to look like. But books have a very insidious way of creeping into your imagination. They're much capable of being much more unsettling than a film.
Also, your book offers another way to experience the sensations, because you've got a soundtrack that goes with it available as well. How did that idea come to you?
Well, for some of the earlier books, I had often licensed songs that meant something to me, either they were lyrically or thematically suited to the books, and I'd often give them away at reading. So when people came to Longfellow or a band out of the mall, in Portland, you know, we would give them one of these CDs as a thank you for coming along. But then a young Irish composer came to me, and he had actually composed a whole suite of music around the books and around the stories. And I thought, wow, that's a really interesting thing to have done. And so if you buy The Woman in the Woods, there's a page at the back that allows you to you know, enter a website and download the soundtrack for free. It's a little extra thing to give to people. Because, you know, I think people who read are interested in other culturally open to other things as well. They go to the movies, maybe they go to the theater, they listen to music. And so it's quite nice to combine those two interests for people and to see one form of creativity reflecting on another, I think.
Now, based on the way this book ends, will the next book take place in the UK?
That's a very astute question, and yeah, the next book ranges. I'll have been publishing for 20 years next year. This will be my 20th year in publishing, and I wanted to do something kind of special to wrap up a whole sequence of Parker novels. And so it's a big long novel that ranges from the Mexican border to the Netherlands and finally to England. So it's quite a different book. Begins in Maine and finishes somewhere very different indeed. I'm in the middle of writing it at the moment, actually. It's sitting on my computer in front of me as I'm talking to you.
Now, this is the 16th book in the Parker series. Has there been talk somewhere down the road of this ever becoming a television series?
Yeah, it's funny you should ask. You know, 5 or 6 years ago or 10 years ago, someone would have said, well, is there any talk about ever becoming a film? And it's interesting to see how far we've come and how much we've changed, and that now television seems to be the medium for books and series, because it allows so much scope. So yeah, it has been It's under option, but, you know, I haven't put a deposit on it yet. I was trying to believe it when I see it, you know. Well, I get when you come along and play with the remote control, okay?
I like that a lot. Now, one of our guys here at the station who's a very big fan of your work wanted to know, do they ever let you 10 bar at the Great Lost Bear?
No, you know, they've never allowed me to do that. And I often feel I should be getting, like, a nickel on every beer sold there.
Well, yes.
I think Dave Evans is really, I think I'm getting the thin end of the wedge. But he said, no, I've never been able to go there. They're always really kind when I go there. And it's quite lovely. It's kind of a home away from home. I've gone writing there, or I meet friends there. So, yeah, Dave was right. There's a lovely, I was telling you, because I was quite nervous about using a real bar. I'm very careful about asking people if I can use their premises. So I remember saying to Dave Evans, you know, the owner of the Bear, would it be okay if I said a book or some of the stories in the bar? And he said, sure, that's fine. And I said, look, I won't kill anybody. And he said, you can kill anyone you want. You can start with the chefs. And I thought, that's just a brilliant line. So he's been very, very understanding.
Now, you also, in the acknowledgments of the book, thanked our friend Steve McCausland from the Maine State Police and Brian McDonough, who's retired from the police. What type of assistance did they provide for you in the writing?
Brian has been incredibly helpful. It just, you know, I kind of like getting details right. And I don't want somebody who knows about a subject picking up the book and saying, well, we'd never do that, or that's not how these things are done. So he was really helpful in terms of procedure. I would ask, you know, how would you approach the situation? From simply the basis of the book, how would you begin to deal with the body of a young woman in the woods? If you went looking for her child, if you thought the child might be buried, how would you go looking for that? And I think people are very open. Most people just want you to get stuff right. You know, and I think they appreciate it when you make the effort. But those two gentlemen have been particularly kind to me, and I'm very, very grateful. So that's why I made sure to thank them at the back of the book.
Well, the details are wonderful. The settings are fantastic and so close to home for us. It creates a romantic Portland that I, even though we're only 2 hours away, I feel the need to head right down there right away and go into one of those establishments and see if I can find Angel somewhere there. It's wonderful.
Yeah, just tell Dave Evans we sent you, okay?
Yeah, absolutely, we will do.
And for the price of a beer, he will give you a beer.
Well, that's a brilliant deal. We'll say, you know, John sent us. Great, what's the charge? Same as it is for everybody else.
Indeed it is. But it'll be poured with extra care and attention for you.
Even better. Well, John, the book is an absolutely wonderful read. It's great to have you back on with us again. I'm still recommending He to anybody who listens, because I thought that was such a wonderful book as well.
Oh, thank you. That's really, really kind of you. Thank you so much.
That's John Connolly talking about his new book. It is a good one, The Woman in the Woods, here on The Best of Downtown. Thanks to John, our other guests on the show, John Corrales, Charlotte Wilder, and Colin Fleming as well. Of course, thanks to you for joining us here on a Sunday morning as we get ready to wrap up the month of July this week. Carrie, where did that go?
It went way, way too fast.
Yeah. The summer months do.
Yes.
They do indeed. But we'll be back. We're on tomorrow. Who's on the show? Thanks for asking. Mike Lowe, the Portland Press Herald. Alan Adams from the Maine Edge will join us. Gary Tangway, we believe, checking in with us tomorrow as well, and good stuff throughout the week on Downtown. Also be giving away tickets to the big music festival that Guster is putting together down at Thompson's Point in Portland. So listen for more details on how to get your hands on those as well. Other than that, enjoy the rest of your Sunday. Tell me you're not working on your plumbing bathroom renovation project today.
I absolutely will be, yes.
Sorry.
No, that's it. It's got to get done.
I mowed my lawn earlier in the week, so I'm good. I'm looking for some Sunday relaxation today. But if you need a hand, don't call me, because I'm terrible at that kind of thing. Enjoy your day anyway.
I will do my best to do so.
Good news is you can come back to work tomorrow.
Yes.
We'll see you then. And you too, 4 o'clock tomorrow for Downtown, right here on Z62 Retro Radio. Waiting.